Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
But the Innocence Project says nearly a third of DNA exonerations involve false confessions. I mean, this is obviously kind of a new thing we're coming about now with the DNA technology that exists and looking back at these older cases. Bob, I want to ask you, I mean, as a defense attorney, how difficult is it to take on a case or handle this when you are taking on a client that gave a false confession that's coming to you saying, look, they pushed me. They made me say this. This is not what I really wanted to say, but now it's on the record. And now you got that mountain to climb up as you're trying to defend someone's innocence.
It's not optimal. It's not an optimal situation, obviously. It's one of those situations where, you know, the first thing you're going to do if you have a confession, if your client has made a statement, is you got to look at the other evidence, right? So in this particular case, you had two guys that had made statements, and one was Michael Scott and the other was Robert Springsteen. Those were the two guys who ultimately were convicted, okay? Mm-hmm. So these guys were actually wrongfully convicted. Maurice Pierce and this Forrest Wellborn, who were the two other kids out of the four, they never actually ended up going to trial and getting convicted. So yeah, the charges were dropped on both of them at some point. But these two guys, so initially all you have is their confessions against one another that are not consistent at all, completely inconsistent with what happened inside of that yogurt shop.
Yeah.
You've got that. But the difference between Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott in this case was that there was somebody that, and I don't know if you watched the documentary, yeah, but it was kind of the tattooed blonde woman. So when she had made a claim that Michael Scott had confessed to her at a party, that she had said that he had did it. And then when the cops are investigating her, turns out, you know, she's like, oh yeah, well, he gave me all kinds of details, but I couldn't remember any of them. But they had this kind of corroborating witness here. So that Michael Scott thing was a little bit different than Springsteen, because all they had on Springsteen was Michael Scott's confession.
Yeah.
So when I have a confession thing, I'm coming in and I'm looking, what other evidence do they have? Mm-hmm. Because I assume if my client is sitting there telling me, I'm telling you, man, they bullied me into doing that thing. Like I honestly don't have a recollection of saying it, because they got my head that fucking twisted, you know, by the time that thing was done. So I'm telling you, I didn't do this thing. I you know, you're just going to have to trust me on it. So if I have that as my baseline in terms of saying, okay, I've got to look at the conditions of the interrogation and I'm going to have to challenge that. But the other part of it is, because I don't think if you have a single confession and it's something of the nature I did it, that is a confession. That's something that I'm looking at. I'm saying, okay, I can overcome that, because I'm just going to say that the cops are browbeating the fuck out of my client for 18 hours straight. And, you know, he was just saying what they needed. He thought that they needed to hear in order to let him walk out of that police station. So, but where you have the problem is where you have other powerful evidence against you, right? Mm-hmm. So that becomes a different thing. So it's like, that's really what I'm looking at. I mean, you're always going to be able to legally challenge whether or not a confession was voluntarily given, right? So, I mean, you're going to be able to have the opportunity to do that as a lawyer. It's not optimal, You know, I mean, my number one rule for my clients is shut the fuck up. You never talk to the cops. I don't care if you're innocent or guilty. You don't talk to the cops without a lawyer present, unless you're a fucking moron, unless you want to get railroaded, unless you want to give up some shit that you had no intention on giving up, or giving up something that you have no idea actually happened and they've tricked you into thinking that it did. So like, you just do not go into a police station or get interviewed by law enforcement without an attorney, period. End of conversation. That doesn't make you shady. It makes you smart. You just, in this day and age, you just have to understand that everybody's got something driving them. And when you're talking about a cop or a couple of cops, their drive is to get an arrest on something and ultimately try to get a conviction on a case, especially if it's a case that they've been investigating.
Yeah.
You know, cause like there's all kinds of crimes, like shit that they see that's going on contemporaneously. That's a completely different thing than if you're a homicide dick and you're out there investigating for years, you know, and you're becoming obsessed with the case. So, the confession thing is the problem with it, Tony, is that by the time you get to trial, you're then left with trying to convince 12 people of that thing that I was talking about 15 minutes ago.
Yeah.
People actually do make false confessions.
Yeah. And it's a simple fact, but it's trying to convince people of a fact that they're hesitant to believe. And that's the difficult thing with all this. In this case, in the yogurt shop case, I mean, we try to have a system of checks and balances that can weed things out, the judge being one of them. I mean, at some point when you have these cases in preliminary hearings and motions are going about, why did this get as far as it did, especially with one of them ending up on death row? I mean, why on earth did someone at some point not say, these two stories that they're both ratting each other out on don't make sense. They're not even talking about the same story. It's different stories. So how is this logical? How does this have any sort of weight? Is it, I mean, was, you know, obviously within those jurisdictions, they're on the team too of what we want justice for our community. Is it the narrow-mindedness of sometimes the prosecutors, the judge, the police, everybody is not operating as independently as they should, where you can have the checks and balances going on?
I mean, when you say the checks and the balances, you know, when you're talking about the criminal justice system, the checks and the balances in that equation are defense attorneys.
Yeah.
We're the fucking checks and the balances.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
But within the system, if you don't want a wrongful conviction, if somebody just looks at us and goes, okay, I see your work over here and I believe you think you're on the right path, but look, this just doesn't add up. And it seems nobody wants to tell anybody their work is bad.
I know. Yeah. And it's one of those things where you're sitting there thinking about it and you're like, okay, how do I tell my boss that this case is shit? Like, cause I have friends that have like been prosecutors and they were just assistant state's attorneys, you know, but they had a boss and, you know, I've always been trying to ask these candid questions of these fucking people. I'm like, all right, so dude, like when you open a case and, you know, you open the file and you're reading through it and you realize that you have like a shit case, can you go to your, you know, boss and be like, this is like, I don't want to fucking try this case. It's a piece of shit, you know? And from the few people that I've spoken to that have been, I feel like honest to me about how those things operate. Like I, you know, they're like, no, you know, if my boss has told me to move forward on the case, I'm moving forward on the case. And I have very little ability to stop that from happening, if any. So, you know what I mean? Like, people need to understand how the politics of that office work. You know, you have young prosecuting attorneys, sometimes 23, 24, 25, no life experience. They're going in there. If they're in the felony courtroom, you know, and they're not kind of the head attorney in that room, then they're relatively new to trying cases and they're relatively new to being an adult and being out in the world. And, you know, they don't have that life experience that is so invaluable for investigators and prosecutors both. Yes. Yes. I was dying of thirst. Thank you.
Hey, wait a minute. How do you get a delivery like that?
Because my wife is the best. The best, baby. Yeah, sorry. Well, we do this live thing now, so it's a little more of a more casual vibe. I'm allowed to grab my coffee and drink.
Yes, you are. Mm. I eat yogurt and stuff. Just sorry, that's probably not appropriate to eat during this segment, but it's all I have.
I know.
Yogurt and stuff. You're always eating meat sticks. Let's be honest.
Well, meat stick.
Nope. Today was yogurt.
Oh, be kind.
I did not get my meat stick today, so yeah, huge deficit over here.
Wow.
If we were to look back at this, and because obviously, and I want to talk about the folks who've gone through hell on this, and obviously now they did not do it. But, you know, the rumors continued throughout the years, and they get looked at strange ways. Oh, I wonder he got away with this. Everybody has their judgments. Obviously, it wasn't them. So, What does the future hold for the surviving accused today? Do we have lawsuits in the future? I know that there is like a fund for people who have been wrongly accused in Texas. I believe it's like $80,000 a year they get. I mean, come on, you stole all this time from these people. And now that they truly do have the right person, is there any now new legal repercussions or motions or moves that they can make for some justice here for themselves, for the them being wrongly accused and those years of their lives stolen?
It's a 1983 claim, you know, violation of your civil rights. And there is a statute there in Texas. Honestly, I don't know what the situation is with how there's an interplay between that statute that they have and the ability to be able to bring another, like you can't double dip on it. Right. So they're going to people that understand the law down in Texas are going to have to look at it. Cause obviously now there's pretty definitive evidence that these guys were factually innocent and they have
been
exonerated. You know, here's the problem with it. T is like, we're talking that from, this is a case that went down in 1991.
Yeah.
Right. And like, so these guys ended up not going to trial until like 1999. So but there was this cloud, this cloud of first suspicion and then this cloud of guilt that followed them. So in 2009 or 2008, leading into 2009, both Scott and Springsteen got out based on the Supreme Court of the U.S., you know, had dropped a new case, and it was a Sixth Amendment case saying that, look, you absolutely cannot convict somebody on the fact that you're using that person's confession without bringing that person into court so that the accused can confront their accuser, meaning the person who gave the co-confession. So in both of those cases wherein the primary piece of evidence was the confession, neither trial did they bring in the other person so that they could be confronted. So meaning Robert Springsteen was not brought into Michael Scott's trial in order to be cross-examined and vice versa, because they were tried separately. So that was a no-no. And so ultimately what ended up happening is both of the convictions were overturned. However, to go back to your point that you were just talking about 15 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago or 5 minutes ago, whenever it was, you know, you had these prosecutors and cops that still had bought in to their theory to the extent that they had this cognitive bias that they could not get past the fact that these are the guys. Like you've seen this clip of those prosecutors. She's like, convictions were both tossed and they were remanded for a new trial, she says, originally they're trying them again. So like there's a year period. She's like, we're definitely trying these mofos again. We're convinced that these are the guys and we're moving forward. So for a year, Mm-hmm. Like when we had the attorney on last night, Carlos, he's like, I prepped for that case like a fucking savage.
Yeah.
That they were going to be taking it back to trial. And then all of a sudden, technology pops its little head in, and they were able to create and pull two profiles. One at that time, there's multiple profiles now from mm-hmm. multiple different pieces of evidence that they couldn't get because it was such a minute amount of DNA that, you know, at the tech at that point, they couldn't develop a profile. So
sure.
At that point in 2009, the technology is advanced to where they pull profiles from both the round that was found in the drain and also one of the vaginal swabs from Amy Ayers. And at that point, they're like, oh, okay, we got a fucking problem. Like this sample, which the sample on both the round and the vaginal swab, same dude. Mm-hmm. And that dude isn't any of these four dudes. So they're like, oh, well, he's the fifth guy. It's like,
oh, we had a fifth, we got another one. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's where you're at. And so ultimately they end up not recharging or retrying the cases. So like ultimately there was enough people back there being like, I don't know. It's like that. This he's the fifth guy thing. I don't know that that's it. I'm starting to think that these guys didn't fucking do it. But it like the way that it was publicized in Austin, and like you said, it was pretty much kind of a local case. Like I don't know. I had never, frankly, I'm embarrassed to admit, I'd never heard of it.
I didn't either. No,
until this documentary. Like in. Mm-hmm. And then I start seeing them like it's one of the biggest things that ever happened in Texas, which just goes to show, you know, like I have like Texas is like an entirely different country. It's not, what the fuck's going on down there.
They wear big hats there, bigger hats than I've ever seen.
They even wore them to the thing yesterday. Yeah,
yes. Mess with Texas.
Did you guys see the one guy that looked like Wilford Brimley sitting there?
Yes, I did. Okay. Yeah.
It was going to be inappropriate for me to bust in and say that. I thought at that point,
like, that's one of the dads. That's
I was thinking that while we were watching that last hour. I'm like, who knew Wilford Brimley was still alive?
Yeah,
man, I love Wilford. Wilford Brimley was fucking great.
He was like, the guy looked like he was going to eat some Quaker oats. He was ready to go.
Hell
like,
yeah.
Yeah.
He was pumped. He was pumped. Yeah. You know, it's like the unmasking of who actually did this was so profoundly just. It was very encouraging in so many different ways for like, but like well, the point that I was getting to about these guys, and then I'll wrap it up on that portion of the question, is that the shroud of guilt just followed them, even though they weren't tried again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, there is no normal life for these fucking guys. And like, I know one of them moved to West Virginia but like this thing comes out. Right. And it's, you're just,
the trauma. I mean, even if people aren't recognizing you for it, it's part of your identity now.
Yeah.
And it's an identity that you never asked for. And you can't necessarily escape. And the amount of, and I believe that there was very well-intentioned investigators on this. And there were some that were just ignorant, that refused to not believe that their shit didn't stink.
Right.
And that there, I don't know what the repercussions are for that. I don't know if there are repercussions for that other than we need more checks and balances within the systems themselves to say, be able to say to each other, no, you're off, and be okay with that. And be able to retool directions of where things are going before things just barrel down one way because we're all on team blue. We're all on team whatever. It's like, let's stop being teams. Let's start being individual investigators. Let's start figuring out what actually makes sense. This is not a team sport. These are people's lives at the end of the day.
You can't undo that's crap that follows like this cloud of, was it Pigpen from, you know, Charlie Brown?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
These people, when they're applying for jobs, they're trying to live their lives while this is going on. They can't. They can't even go to a convenience store and fill up their tank without people glaring at them. Their entire lives are destroyed. And it makes me question, could this happen today? Does this happen today?
Yes.
Yeah,
what are you fucking kidding?
No, I'd like to, I want to live in the bubble where this doesn't occur.
Well, it doesn't. Then you're no better than them, Stacey. Damn it.
Yeah, Stacey.
I've only proven that today. I'm no better than anybody else.
But listen, I mean, here is the upside to it, but it's a slippery slope, just like anything. I mean, with the power of the DNA evidence and the ability to use IgG to kind of get over this hump if somebody's not in CODIS, right? Like, because that, that's what was the gap filler.
Yeah.
You know, they had a situation like here where you've got the profiles. There's a threshold for CODIS that has to be met in order for anybody. Like, the profile has to be good enough. They have to have at least 16 markers, right, in order for it to be listed in CODIS. So if you've got DNA from a crime scene, because there's two ways that they kind of like fill up CODIS. It's either somebody who's been arrested, and depending on what state you're in, you know, they have to mandatorily give over DNA if they're convicted. And in Illinois, it's like you have to be convicted in order to be forced, unless they compel it during the trial process.
Mm-hmm.
But it, like, and then there are other states where as soon as you're arrested, they're taking a fucking swab. You're in the system, motherfucker. Mm-hmm. And the other way that they source it is from crime scene. So when they go around and they pull up swabs. So, and then all of those are put into CODIS. And then, so in this situation where you have the ability to develop the profile, they can't really, they run them through CODIS, but they're not getting any matches on it. So then they start going to private databases, like for companies that are using private databases, and they go and they're hitting all the different labs in all the country. Just trying to say, okay, we have this profile. We want to see, you know, if you got anything in your system that may not have met the threshold for CODIS that's a match. And then they get this hit in Kentucky, you know, like, and that's how they get the, is it Brashers or Brashears?
I wonder the same thing. I've heard it
fucking like fancy. To me, it's Brashers.
There's like a furniture store here called Brashears, and I don't know. I don't know. But with that being said, and obviously DNA, if you get caught doing something, your DNA is going into the system for the most part today. But there's all that evidence that sits from decades past that is just sitting in evidence lockers and sitting in filing cabinets and sitting wherever it sits. And to start getting some of that stuff introduced into the system, do you think we are on the verge of seeing, I mean, we know we have started to see a lot of cold cases being solved. A lot of it has to do with podcasts. A lot of it has to do with people speaking up and saying, let's take a look at this case. And then finally some movement starts happening. People start digging things. But if we, as a system just started going, we're just going to start going through all of this and start putting it into the system. Are we on the verge of starting to see a lot of cold cases being solved?
Absolutely.
Than we have in the past. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think we're two steps away from like straight up fucking Minority Report shit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, to your point, T, like, I think we're going to get so advanced in the technology that in terms of developing a profile, like, my friends over at Othram can develop a profile in a day, right? Like, from the most minuscule amount of DNA imaginable.
Sure.
It's ultimately going to be where it's like fucking, you're going to be able to just stick a piece of evidence into a machine and it's going to boop, develop the profile right away. Like, the speed in which we're going to be able to take every, like, if I'm in a police station and I'm a fucking cop, I'm going to look and I'm going to say, okay, here's our cold case room. And I'm going to look through every single box. And I'm going to say, okay, in 9 out of 10 of the cold cases that we have, there is a piece of evidence that appears to have something that may contain some DNA on it. But we're fucking running all of them now. And then we're running it through the system and we're going to do IgG with it. And you're going to start getting hits on it. You know, I mean, like, that's the thing. Like, for all the old cases where there was absolutely no ability to be able to get a profile off stuff, and they were trying to compare blood and hair back in the old days. Like, if you have that evidence now and you say, okay, you know, it's become so cost effective for us to do it. 'Cause that used to be the rub. it's really expensive to run the, you know, to run the DNA and get a profile. It's like, we don't have the budget to go through our 100 cold cases because we can't spend 18, 20 grand per piece of evidence to try to develop a profile on it. When it becomes so cost effective that it costs barely nothing in order to do it. And then you're running it all through. And then you're trying to, that's the thing that's fascinating about IgG. And one day I'd love for UT to get like really a DNA expert on, and we'll have an amazing conversation because IgG is so powerful.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it's so scary when it's in the hands of the wrong people in law enforcement, because nothing tells anybody anything more than our DNA does, meaning that gives up more information about us. I've been making the argument for the past couple of years that I think that we do have a privacy interest in our DNA, meaning that when they're using IgG, which is where they're finding a hit somewhere on the tree, okay, and then they're working their way backwards to see if they can work towards this person that they kind of like for it, where they have this kind of remote DNA hit. You know, you can't allow law enforcement to go in my estimation, without a warrant. They should have more. Like, IgG can't be step one. Sure. You know what I'm saying? Because then it becomes a thing where surreptitiously they're going to be trying to get all of our profiles.
Because if the government had their druthers, they'd tell us, all right, everybody, today is DNA day. Everybody go to your local fucking office and you're all giving us buckle swab, and like, that's it. Like, we're going to have a huge database. No one's getting away with shit. Fortunately, we have civil rights in this country. We're not going to be able to do that, you know, at least at this point in time. But, you know, if you were to ask them, would you love to be able to have every human being that lived in the United States in the fucking system? They'd be like, yeah, we'd solve every crime. Yeah. You know, like,
we have facial recognition out there. So,
well, and, you know, and look,
it's not DNA, but our faces are identified in public places now. So we are inching closer.
It doesn't take everybody to get swabbed to be in the database, though, either, to triangulate things down. It's like at 90 some percent of the population can be tracked by DNA and IgG, even if you're not in it.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, we're almost there. I mean,
that's my point, that IgG part of it is really just family tree shit. You know it what is. I'm saying? Yep. That's why I'm saying the baseline has to be, and this thing's going to get up to the Supreme Court at some point. It's such new technology. I thought that Koberger was going to be the case if he took it to trial.
Sure.
Because Ann Taylor made enough of a stink about it in terms of their use of IgG without a warrant, and that they had backdoored the system, that I thought that was going to be the case that would make it up to the Supreme Court. Because we do need it ruled on. We need the highest court in the land to say, okay, look, here's the deal, bro. Like, you've got to get a fucking warrant. That's your baseline. Mm-hmm. Have some probable cause in terms of some other evidence, and then come into a judge, say, all right, we want to use IgG. Okay, I see that you've collected this, and this. It's sufficient. I'm giving you the warrant. Go for it. That's fair. That's fucking fair. It can't be the first step to where they're going to just jump into it and say, okay, look, you know, the YSTR side of it, because the paternal side is, you know, we have the same DNA as our ancestors. It mutates a little bit over time, but by and large, it's the same profile. So, you know, I mean, in order to get to that point, I think there should be some probable cause, and you should have to come in and get a warrant. But you're right. I mean, like, ultimately, the shit's going to be infallible, because both databases, like, CODIS is not massive still.
No.
It's really not. But in terms of our total population of whatever, 350 million, it's a pittance. So, but like Stacy was saying with the facial recognition shit, I mean, we're all on the fucking grid one way or another.
Without a doubt. No. Yeah. Whether we like it or not. Yeah. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Check it out. And check out that interview that you just did last night with the attorney for Michael Scott, right? Defense Diaries. Yep. Check it out wherever you get podcasts, and YouTube Defense Diaries. Just search it and you will find it. All right, that's going to wrap up today's episode of the program. For Bob, for Stacy, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast. Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.